We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, Dan. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm very excited about today's show.
I am too. You know, I'm really excited. I get to stump you today.
About preschool.
About preschool. This is. Are you ready for this? Usually Dan stumps me, but I get to stump him.
I'm sweating a little.
Are you? Okay, good.
I'm okay.
Good. I'm glad you're sweating a little. Okay. I want you to guess what percentage of three-year-olds are enrolled in preschool in the United States. That's the first question. It's kind of a two-parter, okay? Just take a guess off the top of your head. What percentage of three-year-olds are enrolled in preschool in the United States?
A fourth.
Okay, okay. And I'm not going to tell you the answer yet. And what percent do you think of three-year-olds are enrolled in preschool across 35 other countries?
I think around the world it's going to be a third, and in the U.S. it's going to be a fourth.
Okay, so in the United States, 40% of three-year-olds, so you were pretty close, right? 40% of three-year-olds are enrolled in preschool. But across 35 other countries, 70% of three-year-olds are enrolled in preschool. When you jump to the four-year-olds, U.S., 70%, what do you think the other countries are?
100.
Pretty darn close. Yeah, 90%. So you were exactly right to say that we were low. And we, compared to other countries in this report that just came out, we spend much, much less.
So two things. One is, I wasn't close, Denise, but thank you for trying to make me feel better.
I'm so much nicer to you when I'm stumping you than when you are stumping me. I'm just pointing that out.
The second is, it is stunning that we don't provide that. And that's because these other countries, this is a national priority. They provide the funding for it.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah. And in some of them, it's 2% of their GDP.
For preschool, right? For before school.
Yeah. For 3 and 4 year olds, because it's that important. That's why I'm really excited about today, because I think a lot of us don't know just how important it is to have early childhood education.
So in preparation for this show, I interviewed about 10 people, what they remember from those early years in school.
Ooh.
So what is the number one and number two things they remember?
I think the number one thing they will remember is finger painting. I have no idea.
No, that's good.
And the number two thing they'll remember is, well, I remember the name of my teacher.
Really?
Yeah, my teacher was named Teacher Bunny in nursery school. So that's like, I mean, I'm not going to forget that my whole life. I can actually picture her face. So I would say the name of the teacher and finger painting.
It's pretty close, at least by your scaling system. one of them's completely wrong.
No. Oh.
So the first thing everybody remembers is some sort of crafts. It was hammering nails, putting cotton balls on a little goat, and painting, finger painting. The number two was the day they got dropped off.
Oh, do you have a memory of the day you got dropped off?
I do. It was probably one of the best lit hallways in the world, but I remember it as being very dark, and I was standing in a line with other kids.
And poor little Dan.
Well, I think I liked it in the end. So.
Separation anxiety. And do you have any memories of a craft?
I do. My second memory, besides being dropped off, was we had to make a clay bunny, and the ears were defeating me. And the teacher came over and put her hands over my hands and helped me shape it by, you know, pull the ears through. And that's it. That's what I remember.
Okay. The teacher was helping you make the bunny?
She was controlling my hand. So I extruded the ears correctly.
Okay. I kind of have a problem with that. Like, I think that there's some rule, and our guest will know this, that you're not supposed to jump in and do it for them.
So, like when my kid played Little League and I would go to bat for him, was that a mistake?
Yeah, I think, yeah. And they kind of figured you, the guy with the gray hair, one of these things is not like the other.
At the moment, it was very sweet that she did this for me.
So. Well, I'm excited to hear what our guest has to say. So I'm honored to introduce actually a former boss of mine. Dr. Deborah Stipic is here with us today. She is the Judy Koch Professor of Education at Stanford University, and she's the former dean of the Graduate School of Education. She had your job, Dan.
She did. She's still my boss.
So, Deborah, welcome. We're
thrilled
to have
you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I was stunned by the numbers of how we compare it to other countries, and I know that early childhood education is important. Is this right? I mean, should everybody go to preschool?
Well, let me just add something to the numbers. It's not just the numbers, but let me compare. I spent a winter quarter in Paris a year ago at the Stanford campus, by the way.
Nice.
And the teachers there who are teaching preschool have the same credential that an elementary school teacher has. In fact, it's the same program. So they have 5 years of training to teach 3- and 4-year-olds. In the state of California, we require 24 college units and no practice teaching. So the difference in the preparation in other countries for teachers of young children and the U.S. is really pretty striking.
Is that 24 units over and above getting a bachelor's?
Or no.
This is just 20?
Total. Total.
Wow.
Total. So they don't need an AA degree.
Wow.
Now, they're also paid very low, right. And we have too few people who are going into preschool teaching in California and across the U.S. because they have options.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's not a living wage for most of them.
So I think that explains some of that percentages.
So, but these to be a preschool teacher, you believe you need special skills? As opposed to just, I've been a parent of 4 kids. I know how this works.
Yes. It's very different managing 20 kids than, and my guess is all 4 of your kids were not 3 and 4 years old. And so that is another challenge. Yeah, exactly. Unless you had 4 at a time. So yes, managing a large group of children with very diverse skills and needs and learning styles and interests is very challenging. I teach a course at Stanford where the undergraduates learn how to teach math to young children, and then they tutor 4-year-olds in a school. And at the end of the course, I always ask them, what is the most important thing you learned? And the most common response is, I learned that teaching young children is really difficult. Just keeping their attention.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, especially when you try to teach some academics, right? I mean, I was remembering finger painting. People are remembering crafts. But we're talking about academics being taught preschool.
So like if your preschool had taught academics and I asked you what's your one memory from preschool, you'd go 2 plus 3 equals 5.
I don't think it's the worksheets. I mean, I can tell you as a mom, for my 3 kids, yeah. I chose a play-based preschool on purpose because that's what we were told was the right thing to do.
Yeah, to help them socialize.
To help them socialize, and also because play, it's not just play. I mean, this was a great quote from my college roommate who was an aide in a preschool class after her kids all grew up. She said, Denise, you know there's a reason behind every single thing they do in the preschool. There's a reason behind the rice table. There's a reason behind finger painting. It's planned out and thoughtful. So most people don't realize exactly what you said, Deborah, that, mm-hmm. that this is really hard and it's a curriculum and you have to go to school to know how to do it.
Yes, but let me go to the play-based issue because it certainly has been the conventional wisdom. And if you Google preschools in Palo Alto, everyone will advertise themselves as being a play-based program. What that actually looks like varies hugely. Often you hear the controversy of play-based versus academic, and it's really a false controversy. You don't have to make those choices because, first of all, kids do need to play, and they need opportunities to play freely and to choose their own activities. But we also know now that children 3 to 5 years old, actually even younger, can develop a lot of basic academic skills that they enjoy developing, that are fun to develop, and that serve them well when they go to school. It requires a lot of intention on the teacher's part. It requires a lot of thought and preparation, whether it's the materials or that sort of thing. But you can engage children in academic learning without a single worksheet.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Deborah Steipek about engaging kids in learning in preschool without using worksheets. So, Deborah, what does that look like?
Let me give an example for math. So I walked into a classroom I was supposed to be watching a math lesson, and I see all the kids taking off their shoes and throwing them into a pile, and I think, wait a minute, this is not a math lesson. What's going on here? Well, the children were asked to sort the shoes into some categories. They could make up the categories. So note that they had to negotiate what the categories were, social development, opportunity. They came up with shoelace shoes and sandals and slip-ons, and they had categories. The teacher had taken a shower curtain and made it into a grid with lines. She placed one of the shoes in each category in the bottom row and then asked the children to put all the other shoes in that category, one in each square. Then they counted the number in each category, and they discussed which category had more. Were there more laces shoes, or were there more sandals? How many more sandals are there than lace shoes? So they had both a visual representation of number, and they counted and discussed more and less, and basically were doing addition and subtraction, because how many would you take away if you wanted to have the same number of lace shoes as you have slip-ons and so on?
Wow. That part is advanced.
It's a great lesson.
Yes,
that is a great lesson.
But they had a visual presentation. So first of all, for the kids who are squirrely and have trouble sitting down, they didn't have to sit down. They could walk around and put the shoes down, and they were counting. They had to learn how to raise their hands. So when teachers tell me that they have to choose between social emotional development and academic learning, I say, no, you don't, because here's an activity where kids are learning. They're negotiating, they're learning to raise their hand, they're learning to take turns. So they're learning social skills, but in the process, the teacher is teaching all kinds of math. Is that play or is that academic? It's playful academics.
So I can imagine people saying, I didn't go to a preschool like that and I turned out just fine. Because this idea that we keep pushing academics to younger and younger, my memory on this may be wrong, but I thought in Japan, there was kind of school was all play-based until you hit, I think, the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they started the academics.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the argument to bring these academic skills down at younger ages?
For one, kids love engaging in this kind of activity. I mean, they're having fun. And two, the stakes are higher now. We know that people have to achieve a higher level of education than they did, certainly in my day. And because the kind of work that we have requires a higher level of analysis and education. So we need to prepare them to be able to engage in that. We have, going back to math again, the U.S. performs very poorly compared to other countries in math. Those countries start kids in school at the age of 3 or in some kind of learning, structured learning setting. Maybe they know something that we don't know.
Let me try another line on this same question. So with my son, I remember parents of their 3-year-old would tell me that their 3-year-old was already reading.
Yes, a genius, genius.
Yeah,
gifted
child. And so my kid was not reading. And so the question was, should I push him or should I respect his developmental differences? So I'm going to tell you what I did after you tell me what I should have done.
Say how old he was.
He's sort of coming into 4.
Coming into 4 years
old. Yeah, and
okay.
These other kids, you know, they were pretending to read. So
you never push. Ordinarily,
never push.
You don't need to push. You have to make activities engaging and interesting enough for children and at the right level of their skills for them to want to engage. Typically, when I see teachers yelling at kids to come back to an activity, I look at the activity and I think, smart kid, to walk away because I wouldn't want to do that either. So you don't need to push. And children have different speeds at which they develop their skills. And they have different speeds at which they develop different skills. So some kids may just kind of grab on to numbers and space and time and things like that and be a little bit slower to decipher letters and catch on to the basic letter sound relations thing that they need to do to be able to learn to read.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Dr. Deborah Stipek about the importance of early childhood education and how not to push your child, how to really follow when they are developmentally ready to do these things.
Yes, but don't underestimate what they can do either.
Right.
Give them opportunities so that you gauge what their skills are. I think we often, especially in preschools, don't realize how much children can and are interested in learning.
I ended up just continually reading picture books in bed with them, and he turned out fine.
You did the right thing, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you.
But I will say this. You feel bad as a parent. There's a lot of competition.
Yeah.
You feel pressure. My kid is talking before yours. My kid is walking before yours. My kid is reading before yours. My preschool is better than your preschool, right? What do you mean he doesn't know his letters? Your preschool doesn't let him know his letters? This is pressure on parents.
It doesn't stop. Oh, my son is going to Stanford.
Yeah. So it starts early.
So this maps back to the question of the teachers. So there was a very interesting study where they had a program called Bedtime Math, where they would, instead of reading books to kids when they're going to bed, they would be like little math problems. It's very sweet, you know, and you give the child, you'd say something like, these are different types of shoes. How many types of shoes are there? And little puzzles. So they ran a study on this, and it turned out that this did improve the children's math scores a couple years later, but not all the children's. And it turned out that the kids who improved, they were the kids of the parents who were math anxious. So by having the bedtime math, it managed to stop the parents from communicating math anxiety to their children. And so I worry a little bit about getting preschool teachers in there who are nervous about math, and they can communicate this anxiety about the topic. And so how do we train them? What can we do to help them out?
Let me just share one more study, which was done of older children, where they found that the children of math anxious parents were also anxious and perform less well in math, but only if the parent helped those children with homework.
Oh, my.
So the math-anxious parents who didn't help with homework actually didn't seem to be producing math-anxious children.
This is why my kids are okay.
Yeah,
because I let them do their homework on their own, because I couldn't help them anyways, because I have math anxiety. We've talked about this on a previous show. I have math anxiety.
Preschool teachers do have math anxiety a lot, and it is a problem. So do many parents.
You're right.
And I think basically it's training. It's giving them the skills and the confidence that there are activities they can do with young children, first, that don't require high levels of math and that they're very capable of doing. The shoe example doesn't require deep knowledge of math. And teachers themselves actually can get into it because it's fun and it's comfortable. So they basically go back to relive math in a very different way than they were taught it. So it's the training of the teachers and the providing of opportunities to learn how to do it effectively with young children.
This is The School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with our guest, Dr. Deborah Steipik, talking about the importance of early childhood education next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
You're listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Deborah Steipik today about preschool and the importance of play-based versus academic opportunities for young children.
Let me give an example of where sort of early precociousness or engagement in math can make a difference. So here's a study that I love. The experimenter has a dragon puppet and feeds the puppet a series of candies, and then gives the puppet and holds the puppet and then tells the child, do what I did. And so what they're looking for is not does the child feed the dragon, but does the child feed the dragon the same number of candies that the experimenter did? So the experimenter puts in four candies. Does the child put in four candies? Turns out if the child puts in four candies, they're going to be doing better in math 2 to 3 years later. And the argument is, well, they're noticing number in their environment, so they're paying attention. So quantitative thinking, some of what they're doing already.
I see. Okay, if it was my kid, that they would eat the candy. So there would be a failure all around. Do what I do. No, I'm going to eat the candy. So.
Yeah, I think there's another experiment around that one.
Yeah, I think there is. Okay, so given that we know that it improves math ability, you know, years later, what what can parents be doing at home to help their kids?
Basically, what it's showing is that the child has a foundation of math on which to build as they have opportunities to learn more about math. There is evidence also that parents who talk to their children use number words, for example. If you just count the number of number words that the parents use on a daily basis, those who use more, their children have higher achievement in math throughout school. And so they are laying a foundation right from the very beginning. But again, I really want to stress, it's not pressuring, it's not flashcards, it's not, it's building math into everyday activities. I'm going to have a grandson in October.
Yay!
And yes, I just had to get that in. And I can tell you that before that child is a week old, I'm going to count his toes. Right. Out loud,
right?
Because we do that with babies. And so they get exposed to number and counting very early on so that it just becomes something that becomes part of the air they breathe. When we set the table, I'm going to ask him to help count out the silverware. When I take him to the grocery store, I'm going to ask him to count the oranges we're putting in the bag. If he doesn't want to, I'll say fine.
Right. I think that's key, right? Because if they get annoyed, I have a friend who made her kid count the stairs in their house every time he went up the stairs. And one day he just said no. You know, this 3-year-old.
Good kid, smart kid.
He just said no. So what do you – if they're annoyed, you have to back up,
oh,
right?
Oh, totally. It's got to be natural and normal. And you're going to find that they'll start initiating it yourself. I actually sat on a plane next to a woman on a very long trip. She had a 3 or 4 year old, and it was a lesson from the moment we took off until, you know, the moment we landed. And I thought, that poor kid.
Yeah.
Right.
This is going to be a very stressed out kid. So absolutely, it has to be natural. It has to be something that's embedded in the way your everyday activities.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Dr. Deborah Stipek about the importance of preschool and what parents can do.
I just want to slip in something here. So that when you think about doing quantitative activities with your kids, counting is a small subset of these. Things like more and less, or in front of, behind, mm-hmm. right? That there's all this language about sort of comparing things that you can rely on. Kids, sometimes when they count, early on, they'll go like 1, 2, 5, 7, and that's okay. And then the next time they count, they'll go 1, 2, 5, 7. So they've got the idea of ordering, mm-hmm. even if they don't know exactly what the numbers are. So when you play with your children around this, it doesn't. It's not just counting, right? It's not arithmetic. It's all these things like, let's make a set of all the things that have mm-hmm. shoelaces. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fun things you can do without sort of tipping into your anxiety about algebra.
Okay, but if they say 1, 2, 5, 7, most parents are going to be like, honey, it's 1, 2, 3, 4.
They're not going to say, you must go to Kumon.
No, and you don't correct them. But
that's key. That's a really important point.
No, you don't correct them because the idea is not to get the right answer. The idea is to learn eventually, and they will learn the order. If you can, we might the next time count out loud with him, and he may notice that after 2 is 3 and after 3 is 4. So it's just experiencing counting. But Dan's right. There's a lot more. We haven't even talked about literacy and reading and starting to recognize that those scribbles on pages actually represent sounds that turn into words and so on. But even within math, there's measurement and there's spatial in front of. But you can do that with picture books. Bedtime math is specifically designed to get math conversation going. But there are many picture books that you can read to your child where you can count the bears on the page.
Yeah.
Or you can say, is the bird behind the bear or is it in front of the bear? Just to begin to introduce spatial language to the child. But again, you don't want to make this a lesson.
Right. Well, and also, as a mom of 3 kids, you're usually totally exhausted and you're just happy that they're going to be going to bed. And so you know that you're supposed to read, but we used to pick like the shortest book possible because we're all exhausted, right?
All right. We're going to count. One. Good night.
Go to bed. So if you're a parent who's trying to choose a preschool, Deborah, what would you say to the parent?
Well, first of all, it doesn't mean the parent has no responsibilities. I just want to say that, you know, parents can still, although I will admit, I will confess, I hope my daughter's not listening, but I did skip pages sometimes to get to the end. Pretty soon she got to know the books well enough to say, Mom, you skipped the part about.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes.
But I hear you on that. First of all, I wouldn't use play-based versus academic at all as my decision-making point. So, and I wouldn't go by how teachers or the website describes the school. I would go visit. And part of what I suggest to parents is envision your child, not any child, but your child in this classroom and the kinds of activities that are going on. And can you see him or her feeling comfortable in the classroom? There are certain basic things. You certainly want teachers who are nurturing, who are listen to children. One of the things I suggest to parents is that they listen for the amount of teacher talk versus child talk. And if it's 90% teacher talk and 10% child talk, that's probably not a good thing. That it should be at least 50-50 or something along those lines, because you want children to have an opportunities to express themselves, to use language, and so on. You want a school that they allow individual differences to emerge. So if every single bunny on the wall is exactly the same, you know, that's not an opportunity for children to really develop their creativity.
I didn't care. My bunny was good.
Okay, I'm just saying, I think to circle back, she shouldn't have helped you with the ears on the bunny, because exactly what Deborah just said, creativity, let the kid do it themselves. If I was visiting and I saw the teacher put the hands on the bunny, that would be the no-go for me. Am I too harsh?
I think you're too rigid. You know,
people have said that to me before.
Yes. So
No.
Deborah, knowing what you know now, how would you have changed how you raised your daughter?
Ooh, that's a hard question. She's so perfect, it's hard for me to even imagine doing anything, even though I don't feel like I can take credit. I guess spend more time with her. You know, seeing how quickly she grew up. Here she is, 32, and but she's going to make me a grandmother, so it's okay.
It's all good.
So I think the summary is that you can do a lot of good for your children when they're young by bringing them to situations where they really get to think and work with the symbols and the ideas that they carry through the rest of their lives, including social skills. And you sort of don't want to completely take it for granted.
Absolutely. You want it to be fun.
That too.
All right. Thank you for listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on SiriusXM Insight 121.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.